A single plant molecule slots into the most abundant receptor network in your brain, borrowing a signaling system your neurons built for themselves. That is the whole strange story of THC. Cannabis does what it does because the mammalian brain runs its own private cannabinoid system, and a molecule from a flower happens to fit the locks. This is a neuroscience first tour of how tetrahydrocannabinol works, what the evidence genuinely supports, and where the science remains contested. This article is education, not medical advice. Cannabis is the oldest psychoactive plant we still argue about. Humans have burned it, brewed it, and pressed it into medicine for at least 3,000 years. Yet the reason it does anything at all stayed hidden until the 1960s, and the deeper machinery it exploits was not mapped until the 1990s. A molecule that borrows the brain's own language. Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, is a partial agonist at the cannabinoid receptor type 1, CB1, the most widely expressed G-protein-coupled receptor in the human brain. Partial is not a footnote. It is the whole personality of the drug. Unlike a full agonist that slams a receptor to maximum, THC nudges CB1 part of the way, which helps explain both its relatively forgiving safety profile and its ceiling effects. THC also binds CB1's peripheral cousin, CB2, concentrated in immune tissue, which underlies some of its anti-inflammatory interest. The receptors came first, evolutionarily and scientifically. In the early 1990s, Raphael Mekulam's lab in Jerusalem, the same lab that had isolated pure THC in 1964 with Yechiel Gaoni, identified the brain's homegrown ligands, anandamide, named for the Sanskrit ananda, bliss, in 1992, and 2-arachidonoyl glycerol, or 2-AG, in 1995. These endocannabinoids are fatty acid messengers, and they work backwards. In most of the brain, signals flow from a presynaptic neuron to a postsynaptic one. Endocannabinoids invert this. They are synthesized on demand in the postsynaptic cell, drift back across the synapse, and bind CB1 on the presynaptic terminal to turn its own inputs down. This retrograde signaling is a volume knob. The system's job is to suppress excess neurotransmitter release and keep circuits in balance. Anandamide is then broken down by the enzyme FAAH, while 2-AG is cleared largely by another enzyme, and these enzymes are themselves drug targets. THC hijacks this feedback loop. Instead of a brief, local, on-demand puff of anandamide, it floods CB1 receptors everywhere at once, for hours, indiscriminately. The precise, self-limiting dimmer becomes a blunt, brain-wide dampening, which is why the effects sprawl across memory, movement, mood, appetite, and perception, rather than staying tidy. Why geography explains almost everything? Where CB1 sits predicts what THC does. Receptor density is highest in the hippocampus, for memory, the basal ganglia and cerebellum, for movement and coordination, and the cortex, for perception and executive function. It is conspicuously low in the brainstem, the region governing breathing and heartbeat. This single fact is the neuroscientific reason cannabis has very low overdose lethality. There is no dense population of CB1 receptors in the cardiorespiratory centers for THC to shut down, unlike the opioid receptors packed into the same region that make heroin and fentanyl so lethal. It is critical to state this precisely. Low lethality is not the same as harmless. Acute cannabis intoxication still sends people to emergency rooms for panic, psychosis, vomiting, and cardiovascular events, and edibles in particular cause severe overconsumption. The hippocampal density also explains the drug's signature cognitive effect. By suppressing signaling in memory-encoding circuits, THC reliably impairs the formation of new short-term memories during intoxication, the misplaced keys, lost train of thought experience. THC is not CBD, and the entourage effect is unsettled. Cannabis contains over 100 cannabinoids, but 2 dominate the conversation. THC is intoxicating. Cannabidiol, CBD, is not. CBD has low affinity for CB1 and does not produce a high. The one place cannabinoid medicine has cleared the highest regulatory bar is CBD, not THC. Epidiolex, purified CBD, is FDA approved for rare epilepsies such as Dravet and Lennox-Gastaut syndromes. It is worth flagging that this flagship cannabis medicine is essentially THC-free. A popular idea called the entourage effect holds that whole plant cannabis works better than isolated THC. This is plausible and widely marketed, but it should be treated as contested and under-evidenced. Controlled human data are thin and inconsistent. Pharmacology. The root rewrites the drug. Inhaled THC reaches the brain within minutes, peaks fast, and fades over a few hours. Oral cannabis is a different molecule in practice. Swallowed THC passes through the liver first, where first-pass metabolism converts a large fraction into 11-hydroxy-THC, a metabolite that is itself psychoactive and, by many accounts, more potent and longer-lasting. This is why edibles hit late, often 30 to 120 minutes, and hard. First, potency has risen dramatically. Monitoring recorded average THC in seized cannabis climbing from roughly 4% in the mid-1990s to about 16% by 2022. And market data in 2025 put typical flower around 22 to 28%, with concentrates reaching 80 to 95%. The plant a 1970s user knew effectively no longer exists on legal shelves. Second, tolerance is real and mechanistic. Chronic heavy THC exposure downregulates and desensitizes CB1 receptors, so regular users need more for the same effect and can experience a genuine withdrawal syndrome, irritability, sleep disruption, appetite loss, on stopping, what the evidence actually supports. Here the honest ledger matters. The 2017 National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine review remains the benchmark. After screening more than 10,000 abstracts, it found conclusive or substantial evidence for cannabinoids in only three areas: chronic pain in adults, chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, and patient-reported multiple sclerosis spasticity. Everything beyond that thins out quickly into moderate, limited, or insufficient evidence. Note the nuances the marketing skips. The chronic pain evidence is real, but the effect sizes are often modest. The best-established anti-emetic and MS spasticity uses come from oral cannabinoid preparations, not necessarily from smoked flower. And the single most impressive result, epilepsy, belongs to CBD, not THC. Meanwhile, THC's acute effects on reward, appetite, the CB1-driven munchies, genuinely useful in wasting conditions, and anxiety are well documented. Anxiety in particular is biphasic. Low doses can be calming, while higher doses reliably provoke anxiety, paranoia, and panic, a dose-response curve that quietly indicts high-potency products. One frontier is developmental. The endocannabinoid system helps guide neural wiring before and after birth, which is precisely why exogenous THC during pregnancy and adolescence is a concern rather than a curiosity. The risks, told straight, the adolescent brain is the clearest concern. Adolescence is a period of synaptic pruning and prefrontal refinement, processes the endocannabinoid system helps orchestrate. Prospective neuroimaging has linked teen cannabis use to accelerated cortical thinning, and longitudinal cohorts associate heavy adolescent use with lasting deficits in memory, attention, and processing speed, with some data suggesting IQ decline. Causation is hard to isolate from confounders, but the developmental timing signal is consistent enough to treat seriously. Cannabis use disorder is not a myth. It is a defined DSM-5 diagnosis. Roughly 1 in 10 users overall, and a substantially higher fraction of those who start young or use daily, develop dependence. The most debated risk is psychosis. The association is robust. Heavy, high-potency cannabis use is repeatedly linked to earlier onset of psychotic disorders and elevated schizophrenia risk, and 2025 systematic reviews spanning hundreds of thousands of people reinforce the potency risk link. But causation is genuinely nuanced, and this is where honest writing earns its keep. Cannabis appears to be a component cause, one contributor among genetic vulnerability, reverse causation, and shared risk factors. It is neither necessary nor sufficient to cause schizophrenia, yet the evidence that it can precipitate or accelerate psychosis in vulnerable people has hardened considerably. Three more briefly. Cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, cyclic severe vomiting relieved oddly by hot showers, was unknown before 2004, and is now a rising emergency room presentation among heavy chronic users. The World Health Organization issued an official diagnostic code in October 2025. Driving is impaired by acute THC, though blood levels correlate poorly with impairment, complicating law. And pregnancy exposure to THC crosses the placenta into a developing endocannabinoid system, which is why every major obstetric body advises against it. History and the shifting law. Cannabis moved from ancient pharmacopeia to prohibition in a single American century, taxed out of medicine by the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act, then placed in Schedule 1, no accepted medical use, high abuse potential, by the 1970 Controlled Substances Act, a classification that hamstrung research for decades, even as McCullum's discoveries revealed a fundamental biological system. The law is now moving fast, and its 2026 status must be stated carefully. Following a December 2025 executive order directing an expedited process, the DEA in April 2026 placed FDA-approved cannabis products and state-licensed medical cannabis into Schedule 3, a historic downgrade, while leaving all other marijuana in Schedule 1. A broader administrative hearing on whether to reschedule marijuana generally was scheduled through mid-July 2026 and remains unresolved as this is written. Separately, Congress in late 2025 moved to close the 2018 Farm Bill hemp loophole that had spawned a multi-billion dollar market in intoxicating Delta-8 and similar hemp-derived cannabinoids. Anyone relying on this section for decisions should verify the current status directly, where this leaves us. THC is a genuinely remarkable pharmacological probe, the accident that revealed the endocannabinoid system, one of the brain's core self-regulating networks. It has real, narrowly bounded medical uses and a safety profile that spared it the lethality of opioids. It is also more potent than ever, entangled with real risks to young and vulnerable brains, and surrounded by claims that routinely outrun the evidence. The neuroscience is not anti-cannabis or pro-cannabis. It is specific. Respecting that specificity, dose, age, route, potency, vulnerability, is the whole of what the science can honestly offer. This article is education, not medical advice.